there was virtually no one who, having got the vaccine, went on to develop a serious form of COVID morbidity and mortality. That 95% efficacy number is just staggering.
So the rescue is underway. We have vaccines for the coronavirus. They've been approved. They're being manufactured. They're being shipped. They're being administered first to those deemed most in need of them. And what's that we hear surrounding this breakthrough news? Arguments. Hi, everybody. I'm John Donvan for Intelligence Squared, the debate series I host and referee. And like the whole battle over wearing face masks and like the fights over the lockdowns and the social distancing, we now find ourselves sparring over the vaccines. Who should get them first? Who should control their use? Who is saying, no way, I'm never going to get that shot? Today, I am going to talk about this new vein of pandemic debate with Dr. Larry Brilliant, an esteemed scientist and epidemiologist who, in the 1970s, helped to vanquish the disease called smallpox from the planet Earth. And if you've never heard of smallpox, that's partly because they were so successful in vanquishing it from planet Earth. It's the only time a disease that infects humans has been truly conquered. And it was accomplished with a vaccine. So Larry Brilliant was there when smallpox stopped being there. He knows vaccines. He knows how they work. He knows the good they do. He knows the politics that surround them. And he's going to help us think through the different sides of these arguments we're hearing now about the coronavirus vaccine. Make that vaccines, plural. Larry Brilliant, thanks so much for joining us on Intelligence Squared.
John, thank you for having me. It's really a privilege to be with you.
Larry, I want to play a little bit of a clip of an interview from several weeks back where Scott Gottlieb, who was formerly the head of the Food and Drug Administration, was talking in a conversation with Margaret Brennan of Face the Nation about how we set the priorities for who would get the vaccine first. And here's what he said.
When Dr. Birx says vaccinate for impact, what does that mean?
Well, it depends on what impact you're trying to achieve. If your goal is to maximize the preservation of human life with a vaccine, then you would bias the vaccine towards older Americans. You would try to get everyone over the age of 75 vaccinated first. There's about 20 million of those in that group.
Okay.
If your goal is to reduce the rate of infection, you would prioritize essential workers. So it depends on what impact you're trying to achieve.
So Larry Brilliant, I found it interesting to hear Scott Gottlieb telling us there that in this time of scarcity of the vaccine, and it's the scarcity really that is driving most of these arguments right now, that we have to make a kind of philosophical and functional choice about what our goals are, whether we want to save the lives of the most vulnerable right now or stop the transmission. And I don't think it's necessarily obvious to everyone that those two things can be incompatible. So talk us through that, since that is the basis of one of the first arguments going on right now, is who should get it first. The choice he lays out between people who are really most vulnerable or people who are going to be involved in transmission, why are those two different groups?
Well, I think if we take a step back, vaccines have been used historically for several different purposes. Clearly, stop people from getting infected, stop people from whether or not they get infected to whether they get a severe case and wind up in the hospital, stop people from spreading the disease, irrespective of whether they get sick or seriously sick. And then the fourth, which was true in Ebola 2 years ago in the Congo and helped us eradicate smallpox, a vaccine which is used for outbreak control in so-called ring vaccination. So right now, what is driving the decision for the way in which Pfizer and Moderna optimized their choice of the way to study the vaccine, whether or not that's the way the vaccine or the only way the vaccine works, the way to study the vaccine is to, does the vaccine prevent major morbidity or mortality? And that's in part because our healthcare system is so fragile that when we are as today, having over 100,000 COVID patients in hospitals occupying ICUs, then other diseases, heart attacks, automobile accidents, emergency pregnancies, cancer treatment, can't get into the hospital. So you not only can prevent death from COVID, but you can also prevent the knock-on effects of a broken hospital care system. And these two new mRNA vaccines have been colossally successful at doing that, 95% efficacy as measured by the fact that in both vaccine trials, there was virtually no one who, having got the vaccine, went on to develop a serious form of COVID morbidity and mortality. That 95% efficacy number is just staggering.
So are we talking about a philosophical and moral choice, or are we talking about a practical choice in deciding, for example, whether healthcare workers should be vaccinated before, say, the population of people over 65?
Yeah, great questions, of course. These are quandaries. And ethicists, I majored in ethics as an undergraduate, but that doesn't arm me to answer this question. ethicists will wrangle over these issues. You know, the idea of vaccinating those people who are in hospitals, doctors, nurses, custodians, dietitians, and respiratory therapists, vaccinating them does come out of an equity lens that these are the people who are risking their life for us. But it also comes out of a practical lens. If they get sick and die, and we've had hundreds of these heroes die from COVID, if we lose that, it doesn't matter how many hospitals you have, you can replace the bricks and mortar. You can't replace the people. So there's that. The idea of vaccinating people living in nursing homes who are over the age of X, you know, the reality is that 80% of people who died in Georgia early on were living in a nursing home. 75% of the people who died in Pennsylvania early on were living in a nursing home. Overall, for the entire pandemic, we're well over a third or close to a half of all the deaths are in that kind of a congregate facility. So it makes sense, not just morally, which I think is one part of it, but also we want to stop death. We can deal with people who are sick and have to be treated better than we can those who we've lost. The other aspects, does the vaccine prevent spread, and can the vaccine be used after somebody has been exposed and used to stop an outbreak? Well, those are really interesting questions that I am interested in, but we may be early in trying to deal with those. There'll be additional studies. We should, in my opinion, we should celebrate the fact that in almost exactly a year since this virus jumped from a bat to a human, we not only have two good vaccines and 144 other vaccines in line, but we've gone in less than a year from a novel virus to a global vaccination program on a scale never attempted before.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. And you would think that celebration would be entirely the tone of the moment. And yet there is a lot of tension around this conversation. What do you think that's about?
This is a really terrible disease. This is an awful disease. Everybody who's paying attention is frightened. And of course, we all have in mind someone that we love and who's near and dear who we want to see get vaccinated at some level. It's a terrible disease. And you don't stop to say, my God, it took smallpox 200 years after we had a vaccine before we had a global vaccination program. It took polio 70 years after we had a vaccine until we had a global polio eradication program with vaccines. That's not the thing you think about when you're confronted with the binary possibility, will I get vaccinated? Will my mother get vaccinated? I think this is totally expected. And we should just be kind and understand that this is a quandary. And we need to get Intelligence Square to have debates on it.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to that. I mentioned at the outset that scarcity is probably the thing that's driving all of this. We're talking about just in this country alone of a population of 330 million people and delivery of first course vaccines. And people, of course, many of these vaccines are going to need a follow-up of 40 million doses. So choices have to be made. Is scarcity always going to be inevitable in the case of a vaccination program? Or is this an unusual situation because of the speed and the emergency that it represents?
It may not actually be absolute scarcity. It's more time-based scarcity, I think. We certainly have a pipeline that over a number of years would deliver the billions of vaccines that we will need. We have cost issues. We have equity issues. We have international versus domestic issues. We actually have the issue that I hate to raise, which is one dose or two issues. And
Why do you hate to raise that?
Well, I think that the manufacturers, Pfizer and Moderna, certainly have said that in order to achieve what they promised, this 95% efficacy, you have to fulfill the full two-dose regimen. And for all we know, there may be another annual booster or some other kind of accelerant later on. But if you look at the data, it looks like one dose gives you some kind of immunity. Mm-hmm. So I don't have an opinion. I am cognizant that the debate between do you vaccinate 10 people with one dose or 5 people with two doses, it's a legitimate discussion, even though I know the manufacturers would like us not to have that discussion. Again, I'm not sure how I feel about this. It would depend on what did the pipeline look like for the next batches of vaccine.
One of our past debaters on Intelligence Squared is Ezekiel Emanuel, who is at University of Pennsylvania. He's an oncologist. He's also somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about medical ethics. And some months back now, he was beginning to wrestle with the question of who gets to go first. And he appeared on a podcast sponsored by JAMA. And I want to share a little bit about of what he said about setting priorities, because he said something I found quite interesting that I want to ask you to bite into. So here's Zeke Emanuel.
So the primary goal is, I think, to reduce premature mortality of people. Now, a lot of people assume, oh, well, that means healthcare workers get it first, and then the people who are at highest risk get it first. That may not be true. That may not be the best way to reduce premature mortality. It may be better to, for example, immunize people who are at high risk of transmitting the virus, both because of jobs, living situations, and other circumstances. You know, so I don't know that frontline healthcare workers are necessarily the first, ought to be necessarily at the highest priority, given that they can don enough PPE effectively.
So what I found interesting there was, and again, I want to point out, he was talking back in August before the CDC came up with its recommendations. In fact, the CDC earlier this month, early in December, did set guidelines that healthcare workers, as well as residents of long-term healthcare facilities, would be first. They were in Group 1A to receive the vaccines that were delivered this week. So, you know, we're taking him a little bit out of time in that regard. And also, I want to point out that I compressed that quote a little bit. There's some small edit in the middle, but it did not affect the thrust of what he was saying. But he was making the case that, well, frontline healthcare workers don't need to go first because they have another option, which is PPE, which on the face of it does seem to be, you know, mechanically true. And again, he was not taking strong sides on that. He was musing at that point. But that sort of musing over the choices that were in front of us at that point, tell us what about this whole process?
Well, Ezekiel is a smart guy and his musings are important. You know, if you can identify the super spreaders who create the clusters, how do you prioritize vaccinating them and stopping that acceleration of the pandemic versus almost anything else? But, you know, I sort of default back to the committee that was established by the National Academy of Sciences called the Equitable Use of Vaccine Committee. And it was chaired by Helene Gayle, who used to be the head of CARE and an EIS officer, CDC-trained physician epidemiologist, and Bill Foege, who was the head of CDC and you know, won the Presidential Medal of Freedom and is a hero to all of us in epidemiology, and a terrific cast on their committee. And they really analyze all of these issues. And their report, which I have read and is available on the National Academy site, it does cover almost everything we've raised. And they've got enough people from a heterogeneous background. And I think that the cadence that they've recommended is one that is a reasonable one to follow. You can debate every single word in that report, but it's really a very profound report. It did inform the CDC committee report as well, the ACIP committee. Look, if we have a speed of delivery where today we get 20 million and by Thursday we have a billion doses, many of these arguments will be moot. Mm-hmm. If we don't get a speed of delivery, and I'm including not just Moderna and Pfizer, AstraZeneca and J&J and all the other ones that are coming down the pike, then these conversations, which are theoretical, will become life and death, and they will become harder to have. So for right now, I support what Bill and Helene's committee has recommended, which is what we're doing right now. If we have a bigger delay in vaccine delivery, I think we revisit a lot of this stuff.
So it's it could be theoretical, and it could well be the reality that we're going to be facing, depending on the speed of delivery, is what you're saying.
I am. I would also put an asterisk on something, because you know there's been this debate on whether you can ever achieve herd immunity by letting people become infected naturally. That's the Scott Atlas, the Swedish model kind of idea, which I think has been debunked. But it's been replaced by this idea that we go to herd immunity by vaccination, which is historically the way epidemiologists have talked about herd immunity. And the reason we have this formula on how great a percentage of the population needs to be vaccinated to get herd immunity is based on real life experience. It works in enclosed quarters, but it didn't work in smallpox. We were not able to achieve herd immunity, or rather, we vaccinated more people than would have been calculated to be herd immunity, and yet the virus continued to kill children. And it wasn't until the same Bill Foege, when he was a young doctor in Nigeria, a medical missionary, came up with a different way of allocating vaccine. Instead of allocating it either to healthcare workers or the elderly or the most vulnerable, he decided the most moral way to allocate it was to those people who were most susceptible in the moment, the highest risk people at that day. And they were the neighbors, the family members, the people who lived very close in a ring around a case of smallpox, because the only place you can get smallpox is from somebody who has it. The only way you can get COVID is from somebody who has it, more or less. So both of those have comparability. And mm-hmm. Bill, in doing that, published a paper, changed the world, moved it away from mass vaccination towards selective epidemiological control, use of vaccines in outbreak containment. He was, and that's what led to the eradication of smallpox. He was fortunate in that the vaccine used to eradicate smallpox had a characteristic that I'm going to call PEP. It's post-exposure prophylaxis. I'm sorry about that. But it literally means that if you're vaccinated after you've been exposed and you're infected, maybe not yet infectious, but you're infected, you could be vaccinated and abort the disease from ever reaching fulfillment.
Wow.
And that characteristic was also true to a lesser extent, but in a real way, in the Ebola vaccine that was created only 2 years ago to be mm-hmm. used in the Congo to stop the Ebola outbreak. So it seems to me, if we can either get lucky or plan for a vaccine that has a characteristic like that, rapid onset, developing immunity really quick, even in the face of someone already exposed, you would then change everything. We'd start using testing, tracing, and isolation, but it would be testing, tracing, and immunization, or testing, tracing, isolation, and immunization. That would be a vaccine-sparing program. It would take a fraction of the amount of vaccine. So I hope that for the vaccine manufacturers who listen to this and the scientists who support them, that we are really looking carefully to see if any of the vaccines currently in the portfolio on the waiting list have that characteristic. And we should think about the moral issue of prioritizing vaccines that would have that vaccine sparing effect and that ability more quickly to bring COVID to zero.
When smallpox was taken on in the 60s and 70s, was there a divisiveness about it? Were there arguments in the way that we're seeing now?
No, I think 99% of people were positive smallpox could not be eradicated. Not much of an argument. Smallpox was the fourth disease to be considered to be eradicated by the World Health Assembly, which is the organ of which WHO makes decisions. All the health ministers come together in May in Geneva when there's not a pandemic and you can't travel. We had tried eradicating malaria. We had tried eradicating yaws, and we tried eradicating yellow fever. And we had failed as a world to do that. Malaria because we could no longer use DDT, yellow fever because monkeys got yellow fever and they were not willing to hold their hand out to be vaccinated, I think, in a nice line. And yaws for a non-venereal spirochete for a different reason. So smallpox was the fourth disease to be eradicated. In many ways, it was the most preposterous, because it was ubiquitous. In the 20th century, the first 75 years of the 1900s, smallpox claimed between 300 million and half a billion victims. It's like nothing we've ever seen before or since. And it was a 10,000-year-old disease that had always been around. But a Russian professor and minister of health and ambassador to WHO named Vladimir Zhdanov, an unsung hero of the story, proposed at the WHO meeting that the U.S. and the Soviet Union, then having 20,000 nuclear missiles pointed at each other, that the Soviet Union and the U.S. collaborate on a global program to eradicate smallpox. And there was a lot of negotiation, a lot of skepticism, and initially the U.S. didn't want to do it, but ultimately when D.A. Henderson, an American who was then running the EIS service at CDC, was selected to run it, I'd say the Soviet Union and the United States really collaborated very well. And the magic of that program is that doctors and epidemiologists from 30, 40, 50 countries, Jews, Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, all kinds of Christian denominations, every color of the rainbow, all work together. Hmm. And that moment in time is what led to the eradication of smallpox with WHO in that leadership position. I'm not so sure that we have the same favorable tailwind today, but it'll take something like that to really eradicate, if we can, asterisk because of animal reservoirs, COVID.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I want to return to today and some more of the us-them conversation that's taking place around this. So President Biden has made dealing with the coronavirus in a different way, and he says a more serious and comprehensive way, a priority of his term beginning in January. And partly he's talking about testing, but he's also talking contact tracing as well, but he's also talking about vaccination. And here's something he said on that.
100 million shots in the first 100 days. And we'll follow the guidance of science to get the vaccines to those most at risk. That includes healthcare professionals, people in long-term care, and as soon as possible, we'll include educators.
I bring that up because his call for educators, essentially he's talking about let's get this vaccine to teachers, was challenged actually the week that we're recording this in the Washington Post by a writer and thinker named Ray DeMonaco, who's with the Manhattan Institute, which is a conservative leaning think tank based out of New York. And he was questioning the idea of prioritizing teachers. I'll read a little bit of what he published in the Washington Post. He says, doing so doesn't make sense if the goal is to get back to normal as quickly as possible by protecting essential workers. In our urban centers, he asks, should teachers get the jump on bus and taxi drivers and transit workers who are confined in extremely close quarters with the general population, but are nonetheless vital to keeping our cities functioning? And what about immigrant farm laborers, he asks. Many of these people, he says, have had to pay for childcare that they cannot afford or miss work without wages to supervise school-aged children engaged in the remote learning that teachers' unions have demanded. So Ray DeMonaco is a longtime and frequent and constant critic of teachers' unions, and I think to some degree that animates his argument. And I don't quite get his argument that teachers getting back to the classroom would be due to being vaccinated. It sounds like it would be a good thing and would let all of these parents go back to work because their kids would be in school. So I don't quite follow that part of his argument. But his basic point being that teachers should not be at the front of the line. I just want to talk that through with you because there are implications to teachers being able to go back to school and teachers continuing to only teach from home that have a larger impact than just on the health of the teachers. There's a question of the health of the students. There's a question about the mental health of the families. There's a question about the quality of the education that these kids are able to receive. We know that it's not going so well with the online learning, that failure rates are high. In a sense, there might be a little bit of a lost generation of 6 and 7 and 8 up to 15-year-olds at this point. Who knows? I want to ask you, how much does that figure into an epidemiologist's calculation about who should go first in line? That sort of knock-on effect, those second-order consequences of who gets vaccinated and who doesn't?
There's a lot in that question. So when we look at any of the various sectors, whether it's the healthcare sector, the educational sector, industrial sector, small business sector, you name it, the people in nursing homes, we can find many justifications for prioritizing the scarce resource that vaccines are. And going back to your earlier question, are these forced dichotomous trade-offs, false choices in many ways, are they driven by the combination of current scarcity and perceived scarcity in the future and the cadence with which we will get deliveries of vaccine? And I think they are. Of course, it makes sense. If you want to get kids back to school the fastest, then you have to make sure that the adults in the school are not transmitting the disease because the kids transmit less than the adults. You also have to make sure that everybody gets tested with the new round of testing that we'll be getting in the next 2-3 months, the $5 5-minute at home test, which will clear up a lot of the issues about making spaces safe, whether it's a school, the Republican or Democratic convention, a Hollywood production, a theater. A lot of technology is coming on board. The virus is known to travel at, you know, a rapid speed that we've talked to us as if it were exponential speed. Science in this 2020 bad, difficult year is also traveling at exponential speed. And all that's coming on board. But rather than look in that direction, if you would let me, John, I would like to raise a couple of names. Vietnam, Singapore, Taiwan, Iceland, New Zealand. I could go on. South Korea. These are countries that for a period of time, in the case of Vietnam, 200 days, Singapore and Taiwan, over 100 days, they eliminated COVID from their country. They went down to zero, no vaccine, all done by various permutations of careful testing, tracing, and isolation. Contact tracing in Vietnam was as much as 100%. In the United States, by comparison, it's 5%. In the case of Taiwan, they didn't do anything different. They were just fast as hell. They just got there really quick. So there's a lot of different ways to lower the ambient viral load so that you can then see the clusters and see the outbreaks and then respond. We need to understand that vaccines, wonderful, legendary, amazing, are, if I can use the Swiss cheese model, they are one slice of Swiss cheese in a package of Swiss cheese. as testing is one slice, as wearing face masks one slice, social distancing one slice, isolation, and all the other things that we know we need to do. And the way we need to get to zero COVID, and we should be focused on that, the way we get to zero COVID is by having each one of those slices of Swiss cheese with their imperfections layered over the other, so you have a pack. This was an idea from an industrial designer many years ago, but it's been resurrected to think about the way to construct a program to get us to zero. We need all of those things. And if we have all of those elements and we're paying attention to them, and now you add on vaccines, then we will, we could be at zero before we have enough vaccine to reach herd immunity, certainly. So I'm just saying, I don't want to minimize the ethical issues that he raises about vaccinating teachers ahead of bus drivers. I don't think that we have the data and the information to be able to ask that question. I'm not so sure we got the morality to answer that question.
Well, do we have the morality to take on another issue that is definitely coming up? And by the way, I'm hearing what you're saying. There's a lot of slices in the package of Swiss cheese. But on the dividing lines on this particular part of the conversation, one of them focuses on whether, given that COVID-19 is disproportionately impacting and killing African Americans and Latino people in the Latino community as well, we're hearing the argument being made like by places like JAMA. There's a Viewpoint article that's quoted by the Harvard School of Public Health. I'll read the actual language that Harvard put out. Racial minorities have been disproportionately affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. Prioritizing access to a vaccine for these minorities can be justified on epidemiological, economic, and social justice grounds. And I want to ask you, how do we have that conversation, particularly if the case can be made epidemiologically and economically, the social justice part of it? How do we have a conversation about that that would be constructive and not divisive?
Well, there's no question that the prioritization of the African-American community can be justified epidemiologically. Also, historically, the Tecumseh experiments, where our government experimented on African-Americans, deliberately infecting them with syphilis in some instances to see how it worked. There's a fear in the African-American community, legitimate in most instances, about can they trust what they're being told? We have to take cognizance of that. And if you just look at the numbers in Georgia, 80% of the early deaths were African-American, double the percent representation in the population. We would be not scientific, we'd be cruel if we didn't take these things into account. But they are of a piece. I don't want to be simplistic, but the major reason we're in the problem that we face right now, and I'm going to go back to that Dickinsonian idea of a tale of two cities. It's a tale of two countries. When those countries I just mentioned, Vietnam and South Korea and Taiwan and New Zealand and Iceland, when they look at us, they say, "What the hell happened to my friends at the United States of America? How could you have screwed this up so badly?" They're looking at that. And the single most important reason that we screwed it up so badly, where they didn't, is we don't have a national plan. We devolved to the states, and I would say to these other interest groups, decisions over our plan of attack to cities, to mayors, to regional interests. It has never been like this before in the United States. We would have CDC, FDA, we would have a group of scientists brought together at the National Academy or wherever it was. We'd make a national plan. It would go to the White House. They would approve that plan. And then there'd be meetings with all the state epidemiologists, the health directors, the governors. And we would all work in lockstep together to rid ourselves of Zika or HIV/AIDS, mm-hmm, tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. That's what's been missing, this absence of a concerted national strategy and plan. So all these issues that we're talking about are each important in their own. They each are valid issues for your debating, for moral quandaries. But they will look different if they are part of a national strategy than they look if looked at in isolation.
So if Intelligence Squared were to do a debate where the resolution was priority on vaccines during a period of scarcity should be given to communities of color, you would feel that that is a legitimate debate question, that one that we should take on and that we could go deep on both sides? Or do you think it's a slam dunk on one side or the other?
I think it's a legitimate debate as long as you allow one of the sides to say, in the context of a national plan that has this amount of resources and funding and that has this goal, and I would say the goal should be zero COVID. I'd love to use the word eradicate, but as I mentioned before, when mink and cats and non-human primates are able to get the disease and spread it, you've got to put an asterisk on the use of the word eradicate. But I want this awful virus gone. I want it gone for everybody. I want it gone for every country. It has to be gone in every country, or it'll come back to every other country, ours too. I want a national plan, and I want an international plan. And until we've done that, that's the place to adjudicate these issues, to debate these issues. If you just take out one, then you're going to wind up with angels dancing over whether it's a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old. That's the upper level of
Well, the dancing is sort of happening already. And as you've pointed out, the CDC issues national guidelines, but the guidelines are not mandatory. They can be they are there to guide states and localities in making decisions, and then the states are kind of in the firing line on the decision making. There, it just happened earlier this month. There was a discussion that the CDC guidelines were going to include vaccinations for incarcerated Americans, people in prisons, and. There was some discussion that that population was more vulnerable because of being so densely clustered than the population of healthy people over the age of 65. You're over 65, you're more vulnerable, but if you're not sick at the moment or have any sort of comorbidity, the argument was you don't need it that as fast as the people in prison. And the governor of Colorado, when he was seen by some critics to be accepting that framework, was so criticized for it that he pushed back and he said, no, we're not going to do that. I'm going to just quote him. He said, that won't happen. There's no way that prisoners are going to get it before members of a vulnerable population. There's no way it's going to go to prisoners before it goes to people who haven't committed any crime. That's obvious. And I find the mixture of the departure from science into politics in that one sort of quite disheartening, but also kind of a perfect example of the problem that I think we've been talking about in this podcast, about the ability of the ability for all of us to kind of lose our heads over this.
I think, John, you're answering your own question. The CDC that I know and love and trained at, and everybody who's an epidemiologist has visited like Mecca with respect, has been depressed, distressed, distanced, ignored, and politically manipulated. The recommendations that have come from the CDC over the past year have looked more like a weather vane than they've looked like scientists with an informed decision. And CDC still has the best scientists in the world. It needs to be, I want to have a campaign, free CDC, liberate CDC. Once you get that kind of science-based advice, because the goal is zero. We should be organizing our vaccination program towards zero. We should be organizing our testing towards zero. We should be organizing our use of monoclonal antibodies towards zero. Everything should be coordinated as it has always been. It's the reason why CDC has always been the crown jewel in the necklace of American institutions seen from the rest of the world. If we can get back to that, I'm sure that the Biden administration, especially Ron Klain, will be able to get CDC back to that position. It still has the same great people. Once we do that, we'll all be, I hate to be, Pollyanna, but we'll be rowing together in the same direction instead of fighting over what are important, critical, but parts of the puzzle?
I don't know if you knew that I wrote a book on the history of autism, and 2 to 3 chapters deal with the period in the early 2000s when the wrong idea took hold among a large part of the population that vaccines caused autism. And what I found interesting about that phenomenon is that the people who were rejecting the use of vaccines, or at least raising flags about their use, because they were not of one piece. Some people were just asking for reassurances and for further study, but some people were just flat out, I'm never going to use a vaccine, so I don't want to lump them all together. But what I found interesting is that vaccine resistance came from both the right and the left. So on the right, you had people saying, I don't want the government telling me what to stick things in my body. On the right, you had people saying, my body is my God-given temple, and we should not be messing with it with chemicals being put in by the scientific establishment. And on the left, you had people saying, I don't trust corporations who make these things. And on the left, you had people who were saying, they're not organic. I'm living a sort of holistic lifestyle, and foreign chemicals don't have a part in that. And I found that really, really interesting that the fragility of the trust in vaccines is, let me put it another way, the trust in vaccines is very fragile. It's very brittle. It can snap very easily and with devastating consequences. I'm wondering why that is. What is it about this particular medical procedure or treatment, I'm not sure of the correct word, that makes it so vulnerable to suspicion and mistrust and fear? And in the days to come, what message would you share with the general population about dealing with those concerns?
So I was privileged to see the last case of variola major in Nature, that little girl named Rahima Banu on the island of Bola in Bangladesh. And when her scabs fell off and they were cooked by the hot sun, the virus had no place to go. There were no viral particles left. Thus ended a chain of transmission unbroken for more than 10,000 years, back to Pharaoh Ramses V. Billions of people killed by this disease. The disease stopped by vaccine, by a vaccination program. I was also in India when the last cases of polio in India occurred. Again, we're close to eradicating the second human disease only because of a vaccine. But the first smallpox vaccine, which was in 1797, was followed in 1798 by an anti-vax movement. And it's partially because it was so improbable that you could take pus from the finger of a milkmaid who'd been milking a cow and caught a disease that was on the udder of the cow. You could take that pus and inject it into a little child, and that child would be free from yet a third disease, smallpox. That should have been a science fiction story, but it was true. And so I think that some of the impossibility and probability of vaccines make it such an object of fear, concern, divisiveness. During the polio eradication program, the program itself was almost stopped by Islamic resistance to the vaccine because of rumors that the vaccine had been implanted with something that would make Muslim men sterile. Bill Gates flew to Kano, Nigeria, personally, I think in a heroic way, and met with the mullahs there to explain to them his philanthropy, what he was doing, and they reversed their order, their fatwa against the vaccine. I've seen vaccine resistance at a level and scale far greater than we are seeing now against COVID. And I don't expect that the vaccine resistance will end because a lot of why people are resistant to the vaccine makes sense. Look, if you're thinking that everybody needs to get vaccinated to get herd immunity and you've got 99% of herd immunity, then the question you're asked is, should I take an incremental risk when somebody else might do that for me and then I'll be a free rider and be safe? Should I risk my child even though I have no real fear? Or said another way, should a kid who's immunocompromised not be able to go to school because I'm going to force my kids to be able to go to that same school without vaccine? These are gut-wrenching critical decisions, and we haven't even talked about autism, which is perhaps the most difficult, heart-rending issue of all. And the deceit of Andrew Wakefield, a real physician who fabricated a study that slipped through the usually good editors of Lancet and was published with that imprimatur of Lancet. And even though he was caused to lose his medical license because of that fraud, and Lancet issued retraction after retraction, once that enters into the public bloodstream, the social media bloodstream, it's been really difficult to bring that back. These are really difficult, hard issues. But if you put yourself in my position, I saw the last case of smallpox in Nature.
And I just want to check, you literally saw the last case? You're not being figurative about that.
No, you met the individual. I literally, asterisk, again, there were a lot of last cases. There were lab accidents. There was variola minor, a different strain. Right. I saw the last case of variola major in Nature in Bangladesh, in Bola Island in 1975 with Isao Arita, a Japanese epidemiologist, who was my boss, who flew me to the island because this young girl was, we hoped, would be, by the way, we had hoped 10 other people would have been the last case and they weren't, but she really was the last case. And epidemiologist after epidemiologist have gone to visit her. Her house for a while was a shrine. We took up collections for her family. You know, this is a, in my world, it was vaccinations and a clever way of using vaccines in a ring vaccination way that allowed us to have a last case. There will be a last case of polio. Hopefully one day there'll be a last case of malaria. These are things that will only be possible through vaccines. So when if you put yourself in my position, I look at the enormous amount of good that has been done by routine childhood vaccination. The fact that 50 years ago, 80% of kids were stunted or wasted because of the diseases they got from childhood disease. They're almost all gone now because of vaccines. So I see the enormous amount of good, but I am not blind or insensitive or dismissive of the real agony of a parent who has a child that is autistic or a parent who has a child that is fragile themselves and they don't want to risk them against vaccines or that the people around them are really smug scientists and won't allow them to talk about it.
So that's to go to the question I've been talking about all along is how do we talk about that? So what you are suggesting is that the individuals who have these concerns need to be heard out and they need to be listened to with respect and with seriousness and not put down and not called stupid, which is often the case, or ignorant of science, which is often the case, which doesn't seem to be very persuasive in any case.
Well, also, you know, like everything else in life, there's diminishing marginal returns. When you have 25, 26 vaccinations given to a child in the first year or two of their life, they are not all of equal value. And there's been an insensitivity from the medical community to look at all those vaccines and say, well, wait a minute. We can reduce the animus towards vaccinations if we alter that program. Right. We focus on the most important things, what scientists are supposed to do. I think there's a lot that has to happen in order to make people understand, feel comfortable with, make the right choices. In India, there was something called the 1895 Bengal Immunity Act, which allowed us, in the smallpox program, to forcibly vaccinate people who were exposed to the disease and were carrying it and wanted to leave their city and might carry it, as some did, to other countries. Probably the most gut-wrenching decision I ever faced was, do you use the awesome power that's given to you by that law to ever forcibly vaccinate someone against their will? And how do you make that choice when someone without the vaccination would be carrying the disease into a city of millions of vulnerable people? There's a lot of other gut-wrenching, difficult moral decisions that vaccines and its both its great strength and its great fear-producing quality that need to be discussed thoroughly.
The last note I want to touch on before we wrap is, in this interim period between now and projections seem to look forward towards the middle to the end of the summer, when there would be sufficient vaccine production online for everybody who wants vaccine to have it, at least the first dose. During that interim period, are we going to have a sort of unofficial caste system of people who have been vaccinated and those who have not? Would they be identified? Would they be traced? Would people who have been vaccinated be allowed into certain places that the unvaccinated are not allowed into? Is that a good thing?
You're opening up the Coachella bracelet of vaccine and immunity certificate issue. This is certainly something widely debated, argued about, talked about. I think it depends on the speed and quantity of vaccines and the availability and to what extent it is the elite who get there first. If we have sufficient quantity in a short enough time period, then the value of having these enclaves will dissipate. But that is absolutely something to think about, as are all of your questions. So thank you very much for having me. Thank you for challenging all of my assumptions and everything I've seen, and make me think about all these things anew. It's really an honor to be with you today.
Larry, thank you for your time and for tactfully concluding this interview and the time you had available. I thank you for that. I just want to say that your inspiration, your idealism, your realism as well, are really an inspiration. Thank you so much for joining us at Intelligence Squared. This is John Donvan, and I just want to take a moment to remind you about Intelligence Squared. We are a nonprofit. We're a philanthropy, and our mission is to restore critical thinking and fact and reason to American public discourse. And we do that by making all of our programming, including the conversation you just listened to, available to the public free of charge. If you want to support this show and our mission, please visit us online at iq2us.org. And thank you, our audience, for tuning into this episode of Intelligence Squared, which was recorded on Tuesday, December 15th, 2020. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Intelligence Squared is a nonprofit generously funded by listeners like you and by the Rosencrantz Foundation. Clea Connor is our CEO. David Ariosto is head of editorial. Amy Kraft is chief of staff and leads production. Shay O'Mara is our consulting producer. Jen Zelmer is our senior researcher. Damon Whittemore is our radio producer. Robert Rosencrantz is our chairman. And I'm your host, John Donvan, and saying thank you so much for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.